please help me welcome Jeff B. from Cherry Hill.
Good evening. My name is Jessica, and I'm an alcoholic. I forgot that you guys dimmed the lights, the mood lighting. I like it. So like I said, I'm from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. My home group is the Philly Speaker Group. We did start in Philadelphia, for anybody that might be confused about that.
Sorry, I didn't mean that.
Nope, we're good.
Just can't hear it over there, that's all.
Okay. Are we good now?
Sure.
Laura and I were talking before the meeting about the meeting that we used to have. My husband and I started a meeting in Appseekin, New Jersey. It was a speaker meeting, and then we moved to Philly. And that meeting in Appseekin is still going on, so that's pretty cool. And we started the meeting in Philly, and one by one, like, everybody just started to, like, migrate over the bridge to New Jersey. So finally, after commuting back and forth for a few years, we decided to make it official and move the meeting to New Jersey. So that's how we ended up in Cherry Hill. So if anybody's looking for a meeting on Wednesday, you want to take a little road trip. Road trips are awesome in AA. We were talking about how much fun they were when we were newly sober, and definitely made a lot of fun and exciting. Come out on Wednesday. Bob from Las Vegas and Craig are going to be there. They're awesome speakers, fun guys. Had the privilege of meeting a lot of really awesome, awesome people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are a couple of them. I have a sobriety date. It's August 21st, 2011. I have a sponsor, and I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other women in the program. And so I'll tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I had my first drink. When I tell this story every time that I speak. And so my first drink I had when I was 14 years old in Disney World with my parents on a family vacation. It was, this was a big deal. It was the first family vacation that we were ever taking. We didn't have like a ton of money growing up. So this was like a big deal. We were going to Disney World, and I was 14 years old and just frankly thought I was way too cool to be going to Disney World with my family. And I made sure that my parents knew exactly how I felt about this trip. You know, the sweet little teenager that I was. I whined and complained the entire time up until one night we were out. And my parents are a lot like myself. They're a couple of good alcoholics. So they managed to find a bar. And I was there with them and my mother. They were typically, for the most part, they were beer drinkers, and beer just never really had appealed to me. I had sips of it here and there. It didn't taste that great, in my opinion, so it wasn't a big deal. But this night, my mother got a some pink, fruity-looking drink, and I like pink, and it looked good, so I asked her if I could have a sip, and I tasted it, and it was cold, it was fruity, burnt a little bit on the way down, but it was good, so I asked her if I could have another sip, and I did, and by about halfway down the glass, she realized she should probably order herself another because she wasn't going to get that one back. And by the time I got to the end of that drink, something had changed. I was no longer that snotty, miserable little teenager that was miserable to be in Disney World with my parents. I thought, you know, I saw the light. I thought, you know, they were actually wonderful parents, and how kind of them to go out of their way to take us on this family vacation. And my little sister, who was maybe, you know, 10 at the time, she was actually pretty cute, you know, now that I've thought about it. And everything had kind of changed. I was ready to go hang out with Mickey and Minnie and have a good time. And I always tell that story when I speak, because it was with that drink that that really defines my alcoholism, because it's not what drinking has done to me, it's what drinking does for me, and that's what drinking did for me. It, that night, it made being in Disney World on that family vacation with my parents okay, and that's what drinking would continue to do for me for, you know, all the years that I continue to drink after that. Alcohol makes things okay. You know, and that's all I ever want to be. I just want to be okay. I want to be as okay as, like, all you people seem to look. Because I just never felt completely okay. And that's what I found that night in that glass. So I got home from that vacation. I was in high school, started to chase that feeling. You know, I went to all the parties on the weekends, and I kind of became like the go-to for like making the weekend arrangements. I had to make sure that I had all the money in line by like Tuesday. I need to know who was going by Wednesday or Thursday. And everything had to be like set in stone by Friday so that everything would go off without a hitch. I'd be able to drink all weekend long. There would be enough liquor because that was always, you know, top priority. And like that's just, you know, how I went through first few years of high school. Like I lived for the weekends. I couldn't wait for the weekends. And my junior year, I realized that I didn't have to wait for the weekends if I knew somebody, if I started dating a guy that was 21. And that's what I did. I met this guy who was 21, and I realized that he could buy me alcohol all week long. And that's, I started drinking during the week, and I'd get to go to school drunk, and I'd leave school early to go and get drunk, and, you know, so by the time I was done with high school, I was drinking on a really, really regular basis, and, when I was 17, my dad died of this disease. He, like I said, he was an alcoholic as well. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. I watched him die in the hospital, you know, that ugly death that it causes, and he was just, you know, I watched his body deteriorate and his eyes get all yellow, and it was a really sad thing to watch. And so I of course kind of used that as ammunition or an excuse to continue drinking the way that I wanted to drink. And by the time I got out of high school, I was living with a boyfriend at the time, and he was a heroin addict, and I was a blackout drinker, so that was nice. It was a sweet little relationship that we had going on. And, you know, I don't know if it was, you know, my size or the fact that I like to drink too quickly or whatever it was, but I started blacking out at like a really early a young age. I was always a blackout drinker. It's just the way I drank. And, you know, I kind of like every Monday I'd get the stories of like what I did over the weekend. And some of them were kind of brutal. You know, I definitely had my embarrassing moments, but it seemed to be okay. As long as I could continue to drink, it's, you know, a couple of embarrassing things here and there weren't really a big deal. But as I got older, the consequences started to, and my drinking progressed, the consequences started to get a little more severe. So I was living with this boyfriend at like 18, and I'm drinking daily. And my mother had told me, like when I first started drinking, that I seemed, I changed when I started to drink. Like there was like this switch that went off, and like I went from her sweet little daughter to this like animal. And I would get really violent and mean, and I mean, I never thought much about it. But then I was living with this guy, and this was like the first that I started to see of it. And I woke up one morning, and I came out of the bedroom, and he was sleeping on the couch, and I woke him up to ask him why he hadn't come to bed that night. And he got up, and he had this like big black eye, and this bloody like gash across his cheek, and I was genuinely concerned about what had happened to him. It said he was into his own stuff, so I figured he was out the night before and something must have happened on the street. And he went on to explain to me that that wasn't the case, that I had happened to him. Apparently he must have said something that I disagreed with, and I told him how I felt about it by attacking him. And that was like the first I saw of many, many like violent incidences. That just seems to be like the person I am when I drink. I'm just a mean, angry, violent drunk. you have your different types of drinkers, I guess. Like, some girls are, like, you got the crier or the partier that likes to, like, dance on the bar. I just want to fight everybody. And I was never a very big person, so it usually didn't turn out very well for me. But it didn't stop me. So we went on that way for a while, and I got my first DUI at 21. So I get this DUI, and I was blacked out when I got it. So I come to the next morning, and I getting pieces of the puzzle pieced back together, and, you know, where's the car, where's this, where's that, and so now I got to figure it all out. And I call a lawyer, and I tell the lawyer, like, listen, whatever you got to do, just make sure I don't get charged with this DUI. I can't lose my license, because, you know, at 21, losing my license for 6 months would probably be the end of the world. So whatever you have to do, just no loss of license. Okay. So he calls me back a few days later, and he tells me that I'm probably going to lose my license, because it's going to be really difficult to try to convince a judge that I wasn't drinking and driving when there were, like, 20 empty vodka bottles in my backseat. I guess I forgot to throw out the trash that week. I had this thing, like, I'm being angry, violent, drunk, so I'm not really much of a social drinker. When I drink, I have, like, if you drink with me, like, it ends in one of two ways. You either never want to see me ever again, or you want to talk to me about my drinking, and then I never want to see you ever again, because that's something I'm just not willing to do. So social drinking's kind of out. And every so often I get bored of drinking alone in my apartment, so I would drink and drive. I thought this was an acceptable form of behavior. Luckily, thank God, by the grace of God, nobody was ever hurt. But yeah, it was a real regular occurrence for me. So I get this DUI. I do lose my license. I have to go to intoxicated driving resource classes. I have to pay a bunch of fines. I had to pay for those classes too. So I was, like, super resentful that I had to go to these classes that I didn't want to go to in the first place, and they were going to make me pay for them. So I was in classes, and they kind of go around the room, and everybody gets to introduce themselves and tell a little bit about their story and what happened and how they ended up there. And I realized, like, I noticed a few people in the room had been there before, and they were telling stories about, like, you know, how they had, like, two or three DUIs, and they were losing their license for years, and some have to do jail time. And all I could think the whole time that these people were sharing was just how stupid they must be. Like, how could anyone possibly make this mistake more than once? Because that's how I felt about it at the time. I truly felt it was, like, just a big mistake, a set of unfortunate circumstances, a bunch of very unreasonable police officers. And that's how I looked at it. And plus, like, if I get to sit there and, like, judge all of you and compare myself to you and say, well, I'm not quite that bad, I can continue doing what I'm doing with and justify it. So that was that experience with that DUI, and it stopped me for a little while. I got a couple of weeks of sobriety out of that. I was right back out. I don't last long in sobriety. Like, I have a very low tolerance for pain, I guess. And so I kind of have, like, it's usually around 7 days I start to get kind of crazy. That time, it was still early on, so I guess I managed to hold it off for 2 weeks. But that was the last time I would go that long without drinking, up until the point when I got sober, which was years later. So I continued to drink, and consequences continued to roll in. I eventually got my license back, of course. I ended up with another boyfriend that I ended up moving into his place, and his ex-girlfriend was still living there, and it was just like another one of those like match made in heaven fairy tale sort of deals. And this guy, you know, it's like I'd say like you know how like we take hostages. Like I really take it's just awful. I hold it together. I hold it together for just long enough until I can get them to like sign a lease or just something where there's like no turning back and they're just completely screwed. Sure, it's terrible. I had a lot of amends to make. Some of them still won't talk to me, but I tried. So now I'm with this guy, and I'm just, you know, a tornado through his life, and we're out one night, and it was late, or early, I don't know, whatever, 1 o'clock in the morning, something, we were driving, and he didn't go where I wanted him to go. I thought there was another bar that was open or something. Like, I wasn't where I needed to be as far as my drinking is concerned. And he was refusing to go there, so I thought I'd just help things along. So I took the steering wheel and gently tried to maneuver us in the direction that I thought we should be going. He said something about me trying to kill us, or him, and kicked me out of the car. And so I found myself walking some dark back road, like Lakewood, New Jersey or something, someplace where, like, I don't know, I was 22, 23 at the time, probably should not be by myself walking. And so luckily for me, the police stopped me and took me off to the side and started to ask me questions like they do. And for whatever reason, I guess they decided that they would be nice and let me call somebody to come and pick me up. So I called my uncle, who lived several towns over, about 40 minutes away, and he agreed to come and pick me up on the side of the road at 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was. And for whatever reason, when he got there, I punched him in the face. So he left, and the police officers brought me to a psych ward. That was my first trip to a psych ward. And I woke up the next morning, and of course, you know, I didn't have much memory of this. So I called that uncle and asked him if he would come and pick me up. He, of course, hung up on me. I called back, and my aunt explained to me what had happened the night before and why he was not coming to pick me up now from the psych ward. So that... I somehow got that boyfriend to come and pick me up the next day once I had sobered up enough that they were willing to release me. But, people try to help me and I punch them in the face. It's kind of typical of, like, what I did. One Thanksgiving, another story along those lines, is kind of living in this motel in Point Pleasant, New Jersey in, like, November. So it was a bad scene. That motel has since burnt down and is probably better for everybody that it has. But I was living there, so I was doing well living in this motel with yet another boyfriend. And actually, you know what? I didn't have a car at this time because the boyfriend I was living with had got arrested robbing a Home Depot in my car. So my car was like stranded in a Home Depot parking lot somewhere. And he was in jail, and I was drunk at the motel for days. So my mother comes to pick me up for Thanksgiving dinner, and I don't know what happened, but one thing leads to another, and I end up attacking my mother in the parking lot of this motel, and the motel owner guy calls the police, and the police come, and they arrest me, and that's the Thanksgiving that I spent in jail. And you know, they held me until the next day, and they released me, and I called my cab driver, because I have a personal relationship with the cab driver at this point, because I needed to get back and forth to the liquor store, and I didn't know where my car was. So I called my cab driver to come and pick me up from jail now, to take me to the liquor store, before he brought me back to my motel. And, you know, you're probably in a little bit of trouble when, like, the cab driver starts talking to you about your drinking. It's like when the drug dealer starts talking to you about, like, your drug use or alcohol or whatever. Like, I think the cab driver's probably just as bad. I've also had the drug dealers talk to me about it, but anyhow. But I can remember, like, that conversation on the way to the liquor store from the jail. It was probably the only, like, most sober conversation I'd had with somebody in a pretty long time. So so I continued. I'd stayed at a motel for several more weeks until I got to a place where, like, I felt like I was dying. I was sure that I was dying. I could no longer keep food down. The alcohol that was coming back up was not coming up well. I was throwing up blood. It was a really bad scene. And I knew that if I continued to drink the way that I was drinking, I was going to die in that motel room. And I did what I do when things get rough, and I prayed to God, and I asked him if he would just please help me. I swore I would never drink again. And of course, as we do, I meant it. You know, I absolutely meant it. And somehow over the course of the next several days, I kind of got myself to a place where, like, I was feeling just well enough to be able to keep down some food and make a phone call. And I called that uncle again that I punched in the face. Uncle Charlie, he will still tell you to this day about Jesse's right hook if you ever sit down to, like, have a meal with him. He thinks it's, like, a nice, like, holiday story. But he came and he picked me up from the motel room and took me back to his house with my aunt, and they kind of nursed me back to health. And I was in really, really bad shape. If I had known then what I knew now, I mean, I certainly should have been in the hospital. I was very, very lucky. And they did. They nursed me back to health, and I over the course of, like, a week or so, I start to keep more food down. I start to feel a little bit better. I can, you know, hold a glass. And I am just, like, super grateful to those two people for everything they had done for me, you know, for coming out and picking me up and bringing me to their house, and, you know, and I thought that was really nice of them. And then a few more days pass, about a week, and something starts to happen. Like, I start to realize that they're just kind of nosy. And a little unreasonable. They want me to make my couch, you know. and something just, you know, that the wheels start to turn, and that, you know, that mental part of the disease starts to set in, as it always does. And, like, you know, like I said, I have, like, I got that, like, 7-day time frame where it's like I could hold it together for 7 days, and then I start to lose it. And that's what happened. I start to lose, and then I justify it in the ways of, like, you know, like, they're unreasonable and they're nosy and I gotta go, because that's what happens. Every time I'm sober, eventually I gotta go. And that's what I did. And I, you know, where just the week prior, I would have given anything to be where I was in that house. And sobriety is not worth it, man. And, like, I'm not a stupid person. Like, I can see, like, I'm starting to put together, like, I have weird consequences when I drink. Like, I usually, I don't fight people when I'm sober. I don't lose jobs when I'm sober. I don't ruin relationships. I don't get into car accidents. And I can see that there's a link between, like, my drinking and the consequences that are happening in my life. And I just, it's not that I don't care. I care. It's just, if you're going to compare it to how I feel when I'm sober, it's worth it. You know, I had everybody, like, my whole life telling me, like, if you just wouldn't drink, everything would be better. And, like I said, I'm not stupid. I can see that. Like, these bad things don't happen when I'm not drinking. However, if you felt the way that I felt when I was sober, you would understand why I drink again. And I never was able to, like, really figure that out up until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and sat down with a sponsor and realized that that's what this disease is. So I go back out and I start drinking again, and I take another hostage, boyfriend, whatever, and we move into this place, and he's on to me. He was on to me, like, quickly. So this was a problem. And I had gotten my second DUI right around this time. So I am now one of those what I considered to be an idiot sitting in those rooms with multiple offenses. I got my second DUI, and I did the same song and dance. I called the lawyer, and I'm like, okay, this time, really, seriously, I mean it this time. No loss of license, really. And again, he calls me back a couple of days later. Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, but again, it's going to be really hard standing in front of a judge trying to tell him that you were sober when you passed out at the wheel and the car was rolling and you slipped out of the handcuffs. The cops did not find that cute. I was just trying to show them that there was nothing that they needed to worry about. So, needless to say, again, loss of license, 2 years. Both times, by the way, I refused the breathalyzer because, I mean, if you're going to do it, you might as well just, why give them the breathalyzer? So they tack on a little extra time for refusing the breathalyzer, and so I've got no license again. So now it's during this time, and I'm with this guy, and he's on to me, and we have this wedding to go to. And I was sober for a little while. Well, I wasn't drinking. Okay, I wasn't drinking for a little while. And but now we got this wedding to go to, and you better believe I am not going to a wedding sober. That's just, how do you even do that? Right. So I convinced him to let me drink at this wedding. And I swore up and down that, because I felt like, you know, this was going to be my chance to prove myself. I'm going to have a few drinks. He's going to see that I can do it. And I'm going to be able to drink again. Like, this is it. Didn't work out. Had a few too many. I ended up beating him up on the dance floor at this wedding in front of all his friends and family. In my defense, he was speaking to another woman. It turns out the woman was the bride. True story, I swear. Can't make this up. And, yeah, so I beat him up. He leaves me at the wedding, of course. I wake up in the hotel the next day. I go to go home, and he changes the locks. He changed the locks on our apartment. I thought he was being really dramatic. No place else to go. I ended up going to my mother's house. And like I said, again, she was a lot like myself, another good alcoholic. So I'm drinking around the clock. She's drinking around the clock. As long as we could stay away from each other just enough to not have some physical altercation, we might be all right. And that was working for a few days. And I woke up one morning and I went downstairs and it was about 11 o'clock in the morning, which was early for me. And my mother was sitting at the kitchen table, drunk by 11 o'clock, because that's what we do. And I had that moment that I looked at her and I saw myself. And I was at that place where, like, I could not imagine my life with it or without it. I couldn't imagine continuing to drink the way that I was and ending up like her in 20 years. You know, I saw what my future held. If I made it that long, like I said, my mother was a weird drinker. It was a little different. I mean, I drank vodka from the time that I woke up to the time I went to sleep at night. At that time, I never weighed more than 105 pounds. It was a bad deal. I mean, the fact that, like, I made it as long as I did was shocking. And it was the first time I had a genuine, well, I really had a desire to stay sober at this time. So I called my sister, who was not in AA, but her boyfriend was. And I knew her boyfriend from growing up, and I knew he was definitely an alcoholic. I wasn't sure I was, but I knew he was. He had done a lot of drugs and was into heroin. So I had seen his life really, really change over the course of like the year that he was going to AA. So I thought maybe there was something to it. I had gone to one AA meeting once when I got my first DUI. The lawyer suggested it, that he said it might look good in court. So I went. I went to a noon meeting. Like 21, I went in. I said that they were all crazy, and I left. And I swore I would never go back to AA again. So they came and they picked me up that night, and they brought me to my second ever AA meeting. And it was an 11-step meeting, and it was awful. I was just, like, I was horrified. I don't know. I've heard, you know, the people tell the stories about they came into AA and they felt like they were at home and, you know, the arms of AA, and, like, no, that was not my experience. I was, like, it was just, my skin was crawling. It was all awful. People wanted to talk to me. Some of them wanted to hug me. And they were talking about things that I had no idea about, that I wanted nothing to do with, and, yeah, it's just a bad experience. So, because of me, of course, nothing wrong with that meeting, it was totally me. So I left there and I said, thank you very much, I'm never doing that again. And luckily he was a good member of AA, and I guess he had heard that before, so he came and he picked me up again the next day and brought me to my next AA meeting. And that was my not so graceful entry into AA, kind of kicking and screaming, not wanting to drink, but not wanting to not drink. I couldn't imagine not drinking for the rest of my life. And it scared me. It really, really scared me. And so I came into AA kind of with this idea that, like, I gotta get it together. Enough to a point where, like, I'm going to be able to drink again, like a normal person. So I'd keep doing AA, and I was going to meetings for about a week. The boyfriend let me back in because I was going to meetings for a week. I was able to show him how good I was doing. And it was, of course, contingent upon the fact that I could stay there, contingent upon the fact that I could continue to go to meetings. So he drove me to a meeting this one day, and I got there. And like I said, I was like, here, good old day seven, and I am done. I am done. I don't care about him. I don't care about the apartment. All I know is that I'm going to go to this stupid meeting. I'm going to leave there. There's the liquor store walking distance, and that's where I'm going. And I sat down in that meeting, and a girl got up, and she spoke. And we talk about these, like, God moments and, you know, seconds and inches. You know, and I get the chills every time I think about it. And the girl got up and she started telling her story. And there were quite a few differences with our story. She had never blacked out, not a day in her life, never blacked out. I didn't know that you would ever come to AA and not black out. I mean, if I could find my car and my pants in the morning, why would I be here? She drank beer. I hated beer. I hated beer. Like, why would you drink a beer when you could take a shot? They work fast. Anyway. But what she talked about was what she felt like sober, without Alcoholics Anonymous, without a drink, what she felt like to be sober. And she described exactly what I felt like sitting there that day, that uncomfortable, just like there is just something not right. I can never put my finger on it. I don't know what it is. I didn't even know that there was something not right until I heard her talk about it that day. It was amazing. It was like she put words to all the feelings that I ever had and just never even knew about. And I heard her. And I got up after the meeting. And I could tell, the reason I got up after the meeting and asked her to sponsor me was because I could also tell that, like, those feelings that she described, the ones that I felt sitting there in that chair that day, that she no longer felt that way. I believe that she did feel that way at one point, and that she no longer felt that way. And it was enough to get me thinking to want to know what she did to make that happen. So I got up after the meeting, and for some reason, instead of walking to the liquor store, I walked up to that girl and I asked her if she'd be my temporary sponsor. She turned around and asked me if I wanted temporary sobriety. If I had known anything about Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, I probably would have ran for the door. But I didn't, and she agreed to sponsor me. She came back that night and picked me up for another meeting. So I came to find out, so she lived an hour away. I didn't know this at the time. I'm too selfish to ask. It didn't matter to me. But she was asked to speak at that meeting, so she drove the hour to that noon meeting to come and speak, and then she went home and she came back to pick me up. And of course, you know, now I've got like 7-8 hours to come up with a really good excuse as to why I'm not. I didn't want to go to the first meeting. I'm certainly not going to a second. As to why I can't go to that meeting. So of course I call her. With plenty of time to let her know that I can't go to the meeting. And she picks up the phone and she goes, huh, this is perfect. I'm outside. What do you mean you're outside? You're like an hour and a half early to the meeting. She's like, oh, yep, I had an hour drive. So I was like, all right. So now I can't get out of going to the meeting, and I go downstairs. To this day, like, whenever I tell a new girl that I'm coming, I usually show up like an hour early so that they can't back out. And I go to this meeting with her, and it turned out it was her home group, and she sat down, and they all started telling a little bit about, like, their story before the meeting started, just kind of introducing themselves to me and telling me a little bit about themselves, and I quickly started to see that these people got it. I don't know what they got, because I didn't get it, but I knew that there was something. Because, like I said, I had always known, like, my life would probably be better, be more manageable, at least, if I didn't drink. I wouldn't get into fights, I wouldn't get arrested, I wouldn't go to psych wards, I wouldn't lose my license, I got it. But it was always that little piece that was missing that, like, sobriety is just so bad. It's so bad. It's not worth it. Being sober is not worth, you know, like, I'll take all that other stuff if this is what sober is. And, like, those were the first people that I met that, like, seemed to understand that. And again, like, none of them felt that way anymore. They were all actually, like, annoyingly happy. And I was kind of hooked. I started to see that maybe, possibly maybe, there might be something to this. So she picked me up every day. We started going through the steps right away. She asked me if I would go to any length for my sobriety. I was too afraid to say no. I didn't know what that meant, so I said yes. And what it meant was that she, like I said, she picked me up every day. We went through the first three steps. I could see how my life was unmanageable. I could see how I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that when I took a drink, I couldn't tell you with 100% degree of certainty what was going to happen. I did not know if I set out to have one drink, if it was just going to be one drink, or if five drinks were just going to be five drinks. For me, it was when I took a drink, more often than not, the drink took a drink, and I was off to the races, and I usually drank until I blacked out. And then the other part was when I put the drink down. I come to learn that that's when my alcoholism really starts, when I put the drink down. And it's why, when I get to day 7, I gotta go. Everything might look good. Things may be picking up, but I gotta go. Because, like, sobriety is just, like, really, really bad, and gets worse as each day goes on. Because I can't live with myself, like, in my head, sober. And eventually, I always pick up a drink again. And it's my life unmanageable. My boyfriend had just changed the locks on me several days before. I was unemployed. And I hadn't had any real sobriety at that point in 7 years. You know, I was 25. I dropped out of college. I lost, you know, the best job I probably could have ever gotten at that time. My life was a mess. It was certainly unmanageable. And she asked me if I was willing to believe in a power greater than myself. she asked me if I believed what was working for the other people in those rooms, in these rooms, could work for me. And I said, yeah, maybe, hopefully. It was just that simple. And we did my third step prayer, and she explained to me that, I had a shot at running my own life, and I ran it right into, luckily I ran it into AA eventually, and, now I'm going to try it God's way. And I didn't know exactly what that meant. I didn't know what God's will was for me, but I knew that I had a sponsor that seemed to be doing okay, and she said if I can take her direction, I'd probably be all right. Somebody once described it as, like, imagine I'm standing here and God's over at those front doors and my sponsor's somewhere right at the entrance way. And just about halfway between me and God, somebody that's a little further down the path, somebody that's a little bit closer to God than I am to kind of help guide me along this process and steer me in the right direction. And I was like, all right, I can do that. I can listen to you. You're a real person. Fine. And even while doing that, like, I had a little bit of hope that it would work, but really, I wasn't completely convinced. There was a part of me that was like, fine, I'm going to do all this stuff, and when it doesn't work, I'll get to say I told you so. 7+ years later, I still haven't gotten to say I told you so, but, So I did my third step, and I got up, and everybody hugged me again. I still was getting used to the hugging thing, and she sent me on my way with 4-step instructions, and I got home that night, and I called that guy that brought me to my first meeting, and I told him that I was starting my 4-step, and I was pretty excited about it, and he was, like, super concerned. He was very, very worried that I was going through the steps so quickly. He told me that that's not the way it was supposed to be done. I told him that, my sponsor obviously just saw how smart I was, and I had entered the accelerated program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said that once at a meeting that my sponsor and I were both speaking at, and she got up after me and assured the meeting that that was absolutely not the case. There is no accelerated program of AA. I am not nearly as smart as I think I am, and the reason that she was taking me through the steps so quickly was because she knew that I was sick and suffering, and that if I didn't do something, if I didn't take action quickly, I was probably going to die. I am so grateful for her having the knowledge about herself and of this program and of the disease to know that, because I didn't. I didn't know that. So I did my 4-step, and I went on to do my 5th step, and I really didn't want to do my 5th step because it was the first person I found in years that really kind of wanted to hang out with me. And I was sure that once I told her all this stuff, that was going to be the end of that. And that wasn't the case, of course, obviously. I did my 5th step, and I finished, and she got up from the table, and she gave me a hug, and she looked me square in the eye, and she told me that she loved me. And I was floored. It was the first time, it felt like the first time somebody had ever told me that they loved me. It was certainly the first time that I really believed it. I couldn't believe that I just told this woman everything. And she was still able to sit there and look me in the eye and told me that she loved me. So I went to take my hour and do 6 and 7 after that, and I cried like a baby, partly because I was just, like, disgusted to see the person that I truly was, because prior to that, if you asked me how I was, I would have told you I was great. I'm a pretty decent person, but now I got to see the truth about myself and the things that I had done, and it was pretty disgusting. I did not come out of that feeling, like, awesome. But the other part of me actually started to feel hope, I started to really, truly believe that with God's help, I would not have to be that person anymore. And that was the first time that I felt any glimmer of hope, ever, And that it was just, I mean, that was amazing. My sponsor, that sponsor and I have become really good friends over the years. So she was, at the time that she was sponsoring me, she wasn't even a year sober. You know, she wasn't sober that long. So her and I actually have the same sponsor now. And, but like, we've become very good friends. So she told me that she heard me crying, like, after, you know, years later. That's the one she heard me crying. She came and knocked on the door and she asked me if I was okay. But that was because, like, she was thinking to herself that, like, she had done something wrong. Because I was the first person that she had gotten to the steps up until that point. So she thought I was crying because there was something wrong. But it was just like, it was actually just a really moving thing. And she said that, like, that moment actually changed AA for her to see what sponsorship and God and the steps could do in somebody else's life. She said, like, that was, like, her moment of, like, this is the deal. Like, AA is, like, you know. So I think that's really cool that we've gotten to become friends and share those experiences. And I go on to make my eat step list, which is, of course, a lot longer than I anticipated it being. And I go make amends, and a couple of the amends that I like to talk about are, first, my sister. Like I said, I was blackout drunk. My sister was 8 years younger than me, and both our parents were alcoholics, so, like, she was all I was all she really had for, like, a while, up until time when I started drinking every day. And, you know, and she lost that one solid person in her life, and I put this little girl through just so much. So I go to make this amends to her, and we sit down, and I always tell people a word of advice when you're going to make, like, a big emotional amends: don't do it in a super public place. Because I did it with her in the Cheesecake Factory, and it was awful. I was crying, she was yelling, people were getting their checks, the waiter didn't know what to do, it was a mess. But we got through that amends, and I get to the place where, like, I have to shut up and listen to, like, her side, and apparently when you're a blackout drinker for all those years, you miss some stuff. She was happy to fill me in on. But we got to get up from that table and move on and start a new relationship with a strong foundation, and, you know, and today we're best friends. You know, she comes to me for everything. You know, I'm somebody that she can depend on. And it's a relationship so much stronger than anything I could have hoped for. Another amends that I made was to my father, who, like I said, passed away when I was 17, and I was angry. I was angry that he was an alcoholic. I was angry that he left us. And over the years that I was drinking and he was dead, I made him out to be just an awful person. An awful person, an awful father, you know, just somebody that was just a junkie and didn't care about his family. And, you know, I demonized this man, and I get sober and I go through this fifth step and I start to see that, like, that just wasn't the case, you know. And so I have to go, my sponsor suggests I go to the gravesite, what a letter that I had written out to make this amends. Now, at the time, if you had asked me, is this a good idea, I would have said absolutely not. I had never been to the gravesite before. It's the first time I was going. I had no idea how showing up there with a piece of paper to read to me what was, you know, the ground. Not going to work, is what I would have told you. I get there and I'm reading my amends letter to my father, and I become completely overwhelmed with emotion. And I remember my dad. I remember the man that took me to all my dance practices. I remember the man that was there for all the softball, the man that played Barbies with me. I remembered watching from my kitchen window, waiting for him to get off the bus from work, and running down the street because I was so excited that he was home. And it was like I had shut out all of that for so long. Because the truth was, like, when he was dying, I wasn't there. I was just a horrible daughter. I was into a lot of really bad things. I was drinking all the time, and I was not the daughter that I should have been. And somehow I just turned this man over the years into this monster. And the truth, it couldn't be further from the truth. He was a wonderful father. He was a great dad. He was just a sick alcoholic that didn't get the opportunity that I did from AA. And through that amends, I got my father back. My father who was dead, I got to have him back. Those memories of the man that he actually was. And I walked away from that mind blown. That was, you know, don't sell the amends process short. You know, anything you think you know, it's worth it's worth trying something new, because it's just there's not enough that I could possibly say about the amends process. You know, today I live in 10, 11, and 12, and I get to, I got my first sponsee when I was pretty newly sober, and it was through that experience that I got to see what AA really does in somebody else's life. This was a girl that was out on the street, never had a legal job, didn't have custody of her kid, was just like, you know, bad shape. And I get her, I start sponsoring her, and we go through the steps, and one day, you know, I see the light come on in her eyes, and I see, you know, her get custody of her child back, and she got a job at Wawa, and she gets an apartment, and all these things, and I just start to realize that, like, this deal is so much bigger than me. You know, like, God becomes an undeniable fact when I can sit down with another woman and take her through the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and watch her life change. So that's what I try to do every day. You know, I try to help women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because who am I not to give away this gift that was so freely given to me? And as a result, I have an incredible life today. I have two little kids. I have a six-year-old and a seven-month-old. I married to a man that's also in this program, so we get to do the deal together, which is pretty awesome. We just bought a house in, you know, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I can see my son's school from my window, from my kitchen window. It's like, you know, if you told me, like, I was going to buy a house, I would have told you I was crazy. If you told me I was going to have kids that I liked them, I would have told you I was crazy. We started a business. You know, I'm my own boss. That's crazy. I just have this amazing, huge life today that truly is the life beyond my wildest dreams. And I hated hearing a life beyond my wildest dreams when I got sober, because when I got sober, I thought it was the worst day of my life. Like I said, I could not imagine my life without ever being able to drink. Like, you know, like I said, how do you go to a wedding? How do you go to your own wedding without having a drink? Well, I got married in Hawaii on a beach. I was okay without the drink. it was a pretty good deal. I've had the most incredible experiences. I've gotten to travel the country, meet people that are just amazing. If I had just gotten what I thought I wanted when I got sober, I would have sold myself so short. You know, I truly do have a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and for all of you, and for the opportunity to come out here tonight. So thank you all very much.
Thank you so much for making the ride up tonight. Can we please give Jess another round of applause?